You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Here we are, Blake. This is episode 33.
33. Two small ears. It's a bingo call.
Oh, wow. You're really showing your age now.
33,
that's good.
Two small ears. I don't think it is, actually. I just made that up.
Oh.
But they do sort of look like two small ears.
Could have gone with Cyril Rioli.
Oh, yeah, Cyril. Geez, the Hawks need him this year, don't they?
Yeah, they really do. What's the big thing that's happened to you this week?
The big thing? Well, as you know, I've been training for a bit of a run.
Mm.
The lighthouse run at the Wilson's Prom. I was training, I was off on a run, came around the corner, stepped into, I'm going to say it was a Telstra, you know, one of those little Telstra sort of, it's just a bit lower than the actual concrete itself.
Yeah, don't get us a lawsuit here, it could have been any manhole cover.
No, I'm going to go Telstra. And rolled the ankle. And so I'm going to have to put my feet up for a few weeks, mate.
How'd you handle it?
Well, after I stopped crying, I reckon I've handled it okay. Well, actually, I couldn't walk home because I was about 6 Ks away from home and rang Amelia and said, come get me. But, mate, I've just I'm just going to eat my way through this, eat my way through the rehabilitation process.
Well, fascinating segue. What's because that? Our guest today is a runner, an extremely good runner.
He is a good runner.
He also describes himself as a chef to his kids.
That's true.
But in reality, he's a little bit different.
He is. We are talking to
Marcus Godinho.
And what does Marcus do?
He's the CEO of a company called Fair Share.
So what does Fair Share do?
At a high level.
Yeah, just give us the high level.
It is they take surplus food from organisations such as supermarkets, cook it, package it, and then distribute it to people who don't have access to highly nutritious food.
Yeah. And he's done an amazing job. You know what? This one for me is for all those people out there, and yes, I'm talking to you, who have followed the straight line with their career and just done what they thought that they should do and perhaps haven't...
Or what other people thought they should do.
Correct. Perhaps haven't followed what they're passionate about. Marcus jumped off that straight line. Let's see how he did that. Here's Marcus Godinho.
Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say,
do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
Hey Marcus, welcome to the Doolanders. How are you?
Great to be with you guys.
Fantastic to have you. Nick.
Hi Blake.
Co-CEO of the Doolanders, how are you?
As we've just established.
We have just established that. Marcus, tell us or tell our listeners, what do you do?
What do I do?
Yeah.
I'm a husband.
Good.
Dad with two boys.
Yeah.
They think I'm a chef.
Do they?
I'm okay in the kitchen. They're 8 and 6. Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Raph and Remy. What now, 17 years or so, I've been involved with a fantastic community initiative called Fair Share, which collects surplus food from businesses and we cook it into nutritious meals that we give to local charities around Australia for free to help people who've fallen on hard times.
How good is that? That must feel good, waking up each day going, this is what we do.
Oh, look, it nourishes the soul. It presses so many buttons for me because it's about sustainability. It's about helping people who've fallen on hard times. We've got 1,000 regular volunteers, so it's about bringing people together. It's empowering them to do something that allows them to give back and to have social contact. So, it's really rewarding. And it's fun, and you've got to be creative.
Yeah.
You know, you get a phone call from somebody and they've got 55 tons of crushed tomatoes in 44-gallon drums in Shepparton, and immediately you go, ooh, that would be good. Now, how do we get that down to Melbourne? How quickly can we use it? How much time has it got on it? What can we cook with it?
What is the most strangest or the hardest solve for or ask you've ever had? So it might have been the 55 tons of tomatoes. Do you remember thinking, oh my goodness, 732 million loaves of bread, what are we going to do with that?
I remember getting home from camping one weekend. The boys were really young and we were unpacking the car, and I took a call because you never know, you might be on the other end. I've learnt that running a charity. And a bloke was ringing up because it was a religious festival. And he'd slaughtered two goats, and he'd served up one to the family that day, and he had another one, and he wanted to donate to Fair Share. And Lisa's looking at me going, come on, we need to unload the car. Do you need to go into work? I said, I'm not going into work because a bloke is parked outside late on a Sunday afternoon complaining that we're shut, and he's got a slaughtered goat in the back of his ute.
Yeah.
But your mind does go to think, well, you know, goat's good. It's full of protein. We could do something with that. But no.
One goat ain't going to go that far, is it?
Look, you know, you make the most when people offer you things you really want to use. Yeah, it. But also you've got to be careful, you know, because we're cooking for some of the most vulnerable people in society. And, you just can't take risk with food.
Yeah.
You just got to play it safe. But another great one was these jars that came in that said smoke in water.
So, hang on. And I said, smoke in water?
Yeah, not smoke on the water.
Right, I was going to say.
Not Deep Purple. And I said to the chef, what is that? And she said, it's smoke in water. I said, yeah, I can read that, but what do you do with it? Well, you know, if you're cooking a paella on a stove outside on one of those ring burners and you want to get that traditional flavour of smokiness that the Spaniards would have got in their paella when they're cooking on an open fire, then you just, you know, pour some of this into it. It's like, right, okay, well, that's going to enhance the nutrition of our meals. We don't do many paella.
I've never heard of a jar full of smoke and water. Anyway, now I have. You're talking about vulnerability and the people that you are trying to help on a day-to-day basis. We've just spent a crazy amount of time trying to navigate our way through COVID-19, and you know, I think the feeling of vulnerability has increased for many, many people across the globe. And how did COVID-19 affect your business or your organisation and what you did?
Yeah, look, I think a lot of people never expected to be in a situation where they'd be turning to a charity for support for food.
Yeah.
For us, I mean, personally, there was panic, because we have 1,000 different people volunteering with us every week between our Brisbane and Melbourne facilities, and they're shoulder to shoulder. It's a high turnover of people coming in and helping out, and yet we were being told that we needed to reduce human contact, we needed to social distance, and it was sort of the anti-COVID environment. So I remember saying on a Friday morning to Kelly, who'd run our operations for more than 10 years, I said, look, we need to rethink this. We need to look at how we could run our kitchens, because our meals are going to be needed more than ever before, with a small number of full-time, paid, highly productive hospitality professionals.
Mm.
And she said, that's my dream, but how could we ever afford that? I said, I don't know, but we need to have a solution ready and be proactive and go out and try and find some funding, or, you know, you never know. It's Fair Share. Things can sometimes land in our laps. The very next day, we got a call from the state government saying, look, ordinarily, we don't support you. You've got to fundraise to cover your own costs, but right now we need you cooking as many meals as you can. And there's a lot of hospitality venues that are shutting down. There are a lot of people who are going to be looking for work. So can you send us in a proposal over the weekend for picking up people who've lost their jobs because of the pandemic to run your kitchen full time? Between the support we got from the Victorian government and the ALH group, which is now mostly owned by Woolworths, spoke with Bruce Matheson Jr. and he said, look, I've got all these chefs who can't go to work. Can we deploy them in your kitchen? So I remember within the space of a week, well, we finished on a Friday with volunteers. On the Monday, we rebooted both Brisbane and Melbourne with a highly qualified group of chefs.
That's creativity at its best, isn't it? Like, you know, to bring all of that together in 48 hours, amazing.
It was highly intimidating. I was down there at 6 o'clock on Monday morning inducting the first group coming through and I said, do you guys know each other because you're within the same group? And no, they were across many venues. And as they went around and introduced themselves, head chef, exec chef, sous chef, our regular kitchen chefs, of which there are half a dozen in Melbourne, just went, oh, gee.
We're playing with the big boys now. And what did it do to productivity?
Double production.
Did
so
it really?
At one point we were cooking 140,000 meals a week between the two kitchens. Doubled.
Wow.
Just through the increased capabilities or?
Yeah, both through the highly productive workforce that we had, but also because the pandemic really screwed with the system, the food system, because so many businesses all of a sudden couldn't operate and it just threw up a whole lot of donations of surplus food that we had banked. And at the same time, we were just off the back of the bushfires and there were massive donations of food coming into the sector at that time as well. So we'd really banked. We've got 90 pallets of freezer space down at our warehouse in Derrimut and that was full of food ready to go. So, and another 200 pallets off-site, frozen. So we were well endowed.
Yeah, fantastic. What amazing work. On the Doolanders, what we like to do is find out about who you are and where you've been and how you arrived at where you are today. So your parents met whilst they were in Australia, but you were born in Portugal. Is that right?
Yeah, Dad was about 20 years older than Mum and Mum was a pregnant 19-year-old accident.
Right.
Parents were not sure what to do and sort of encouraged them to go overseas and have a child.
Okay.
Pretend to elope. Right. Go away.
Right.
Problem,
okay.
Go away.
Okay.
I think they went to Portugal, but via Mozambique, Angola and France, where I popped out in Lisbon and spent my first year there and then they were back to Australia. And,
Where'd you grow up?
In Melbourne,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The leafy suburb of?
South Yarra.
Nice.
It was.
And how was your childhood?
Couldn't live there now. Too developed. Yeah. As we sit here looking out onto a lot of eucalypts in our suburb of Alphington.
Yeah. It's a unknown little treasure, this place, isn't it?
Oh.
Alphington. How was your childhood? What were you into as a kid?
Oh, what we all did. We played cricket in the lane next to us. We went down to the park and kicked the footy around.
Mm. Who do you follow in the footy, by the way?
Long-suffering Hawthorn supporter.
Well, that's the three of us here today. Go Hawks! We're in for a very, very big 2021. We might win three or four games. Anyway.
Just a regular child. Oh, I was a bit screwed up. Dad was a bit of a – made some interesting choices, not the nicest of people.
Right.
I think Mum kicked him out after about 4 years.
Yeah. Your mum's a teacher?
Mum was a teacher, mm-hmm. Primary school teacher, and then – Went to back to university and did a PhD in education and taught there for the rest of her career. Mm. So, yeah. But no, I had a wonderful stepfather who really raised us well.
Yeah.
So I sort of had him as a de facto father.
Fantastic. And he had a relatively interesting occupation at one stage, didn't he?
He was a jackaroo. He was a stock agent, rural real estate agent. So, yeah, I've got a real love for the bush. I reckon its genesis lay with all the trips he took us up to the bush. Yeah.
And you were just telling us before we pressed go on the podcast that you've got your own beautiful parcel of bush these days that you escape off to.
Yeah, well, yeah, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. My old man said it's how colourful can we be with language on this?
Yeah, you can say whatever you like. You can say whatever you like.
What are you buying up there? That land's fucked. This is rocks throughout it. It's just, oh, God. I said, well, yeah, it's cheap. We can afford it. So, yeah, just south of Heathcote, right next door to Puckapunyal, which does sound very colourful or loud, but is actually beautiful. It's like looking into National Park or State Forest.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, so it's our happy place. We've spent quite a few years just pouring so much blood, sweat into it. It's wonderful watching the land return.
Brilliant. As a teenager, did you have any inkling as to what lay ahead in terms of your career and what you wanted to do?
No. A couple of my closest mates did economics at school in year 11, and so I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I really enjoyed that. So I did that in year 12 and then went and did the thing you should do if you're a private school kid growing up in South Yarra. You go to Melbourne University and you do a commerce degree and it's all straight line. You finish that and you go and get a job with a big corporate. So far so good, my parents would have thought.
Yeah.
Hasn't deviated.
So you regret it, Mobile. You followed that straight line into Mobile.
Yep.
And you're doing accounting and finance.
Yep. And then the company restructured and they pulled all the grads off that program and they said, Marcus, we don't think you're cut out to be an accountant. And I said, yeah, sort of got that self-awareness.
You're right.
Building.
Yeah.
But I'm a keen runner and I've been running quite a lot at lunchtimes, and the general manager of corporate affairs, Ron Burke, quite often would be toweling down at the same time. And so we knew each other, and HR said, look, there's this job going in corporate affairs. Do you want to, would you be interested in that? So I went up and saw Mr. Burke and he told me what was involved, and it sounded really interesting. Yeah. So that was my exit.
Right. Accounting and finance. Yeah. Sounds like a good idea. Just back on your running.
Horses
like,
for courses.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Whatever floats your boat. Just back on your running. Both Nick and I are prolific sweaters. And, well, Nick probably more than me. But I reckon if I went for a run at work during the day at lunchtime, like it'd be 2 o'clock before I'd actually stop sweating. Like,
yeah.
You know, you'd have to have 80. I'd have to have so many shirts. Was that a problem?
Yep. Small change room in the basement,
yeah,
and
yeah,
a bunch of sweaty guys,
yeah,
and the steam, and you're, yeah, hot, and you,
yeah,
how quickly can I cool down,
yeah,
manage your stretching, and yeah, all,
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
yeah. No meetings.
You walk into
lunch.
The next meeting, you're just beating up.
Oh, and absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, the beauty of it. So, you found yourself in a role at NAB next up after Mobile, which you've described as it was perhaps intellectually challenging, but it didn't engage your soul. What were you doing there?
Yeah, look, that general manager I had at Mobile in corporate affairs, Ron Burke, got poached by Don Arcus and went over to head up corporate affairs globally for NAB because it had a number of operations overseas, and he rang me up one day and said, is that ex-girlfriend of yours still looking to exit the law? Because I might have a job for her.
Right.
And I said, yeah, she is. I'll put you in touch with her. But what about me? I saw you on the market. I said, well, I might be. So he had lunch with her one day, same seat, same restaurant, had lunch with me the next day. And I found myself separated from my ex-girlfriend by a petition, working on the 29th floor of 500 Bourke Street. But no, look, seriously, the job was fascinating and intellectually stimulating, just as the work at Mobil had been. But at Mobil, I just had this feeling that, look, as interesting as the work is, it's just not really fulfilling. Mm. I just felt that I can, yeah, just wasn't contributing something to society more generally.
Yeah.
But I thought I should try something else because I'd followed that straight line.
Yeah.
And try a different flavour of corporate and, but same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, get out of bed, go to work, do a good job, but you just think, no, there's got to be more to it than this. Mm.
So when did that straight line start to curve away a little bit?
Well, the feeling was there, but I was doing an MBA. I'd started at Mobil and was going through it at NAB, and I remember walking into my last exam and a bloke tapped me on the shoulder and said, you're kind of interested in that environmental stuff. There's a job going at the Australian Conservation Foundation. Mm. And what had really, I guess, turned the light on for me was there was a subject back then, and this was in the, was it 1997, a bloke called Peter Kinraid from the Australian Conservation Foundation came and spoke to us about climate change and international treaties and the work that ACF was doing. And I just thought, this is just, I've got to work on this. So it really, and I was rabbiting on about it, so that's why somebody walking into that last lecture told me about that job going at ACF. But, in terms of where to go, that was that lightning bolt moment. And it's that time of life, Saturn returns, late 20s. People quite often get that itch.
So he went and scratched that itch, walked into the ACF and reported into a guy called Don Henry, is that right?
Well, Don started a few months after I started, but just an inspiring individual.
So in what way? In what way?
Oh, just somebody who was so committed, incredibly hardworking, such a breadth of experience working in Washington, working on Brazilian rainforest protection, on environmental issues, just such a giving person, incredibly modest, despite his intellectual capacity, and loves a drink.
what a well-rounded human he is.
Uncle Don, I mean, just such a special Australian, and just really fortunate to count him as a friend, and was great. But I remember after about 18 months of working for him, said, look, I really see myself going in this direction. And it was a little bit like when your older son. And I thought, nah, I'm too impatient for that.
You did a stint in a government role, is that right, or a government project?
Yeah, after working at ACF, found myself working in a state government environment agency for 9 months, and just was like hitting my forehead up against a wall. Good people and important work that they could be doing, but just so hamstrung by the confines of government policy.
Mm.
So whereas I was used to being involved in an organisation that was really trying to set the government agenda, really trying to encourage, pursue, stronger environmental outcomes. So, it was that self-awareness, important work that government does on environment, but I need to be outside of government.
And was that outside of government so that you could make a bigger impact?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not very good at being told, no, you can't do that. No, that's not what we can do.
Yeah.
So why not? So, look, I know some wonderful people who work within environmental agencies, within government, doing really good work and important work and who do it well, especially people who are beyond policy development, but not for me.
Yeah. So the next stage in your career, this sounds like an incredibly important role as CEO of Environment Victoria. Tell us what that role entailed and what you were trying to achieve.
Yeah, look, having that self-awareness of, working on environmental issues within government, isn't working for me. The job came up running Environment Victoria, and I thought, gee, that's that brand's got a bit of gravitas. I sort of know of them. They're pretty small, but I reckon climate change is emerging. No, climate change was just emerging. The drought was really biting. And I thought, gee, we could do something on environmental advocacy on those issues and other issues. So I threw my hat in the ring and was lucky enough to get the job. Work with a terrific group of people, especially one guy, Paul Sinclair, who was just, fantastic comrade, great environmental advocate, and still is, as second in charge at the Australian Conservation Foundation. So had 6 years there, but there was that, as much as I was really passionate about the work and just poured so much into the organisation, had the awareness that that challenging work of environmental advocacy is not really playing to my strengths, and there are people who are better at it. So, yeah, eventually. And, there's only so many times I could meet with John Brumby in January telling him what priorities the environment movement had for the budget. Okay, it's someone else's turn.
Yeah.
to pick what, this up.
Was it just like banging your head against a brick wall? Was it unrelenting? Was it combative? How did you win?
Yeah. No, look, I mean, I was really fortunate because, as Don Henry said to me, it's not often you get a state government that provides such opportunity for advancements in the environment. You had a team that was pretty, quite often state government doesn't bat too deep. This government did. There were some really good people, capable people there. And so the timing was really right. As Don said, the stars really align at the moment with the state government. But still, it's adversarial. You've got farmers that don't necessarily, some who don't necessarily like what you're doing, and farming bodies. You've got, mineral groups who don't want to give up coal. You've got businesses who are going to be affected. You've got unions who don't want jobs lost. So it's feisty, and it's tough, and it gets personal, and it's very quick on your feet. It's hard work. Really hard work, but it's critical work. Yeah. And there are some who do it really, really well, and I think that, but such important work needs to be done by those who that work suits.
Yeah. You were having lunch at a lunch that was put on by the Pratt Foundation. I think it was Women in Football, and you were tossing up between the chicken and beef, and a lady was sitting next to you, and she was having a chat to you that was food related.
Yeah, look, it was one of those lunches where you think, oh, do I go to this or not? And it was an important donor, the Pratt Foundation, which had supported us over the years, and I thought I should go, and you never know who you might meet. So I was sitting next to a young woman who was quite attractive, and I was single, and she was telling me about this work she did once a month on a Saturday morning in this small kitchen in South Melbourne. And it really spoke to me because I really could see that food would emerge as a big environmental issue, knowing the food print, as we call it, knowing the economic impact that food has. She was rostered on that next Saturday morning, or that Saturday morning, and she said she should come along. So I went along and I met her boyfriend. And they got married. but I just loved it. And being a wog and loving food, and it's Melbourne. We love cooking, we love eating, we love entertaining. I really enjoyed it. At the end of a week, going down to the kitchen, volunteering there once a month on a Saturday morning, that same shift. You could switch your brain off, you could shop, you could have a bit of a chat, a bit of banter, and then early afternoon, pack up and go home. So I just really enjoyed it. People in Melbourne go hungry? Really? Wasn't aware of that. So my access to it was through, I guess, food and food sustainability. That's what motivated me to get involved. Mm. And I said, I'll come back next Saturday. And I remember Julian, the woman who was running the kitchen that day, said, well, we've got enough people coming in on Saturdays. You can come once a month. So, and it's, you know, to this day, Ayrshire's got about 1,000 people on the waiting list who want to become regular volunteers.
That's amazing.
On the waiting list.
On the waiting list. So we've got 1,000 regular volunteers in Melbourne. We've got the same number again on the waiting list.
Wow.
I think a few of them will have dropped off over COVID, but yeah, very fortunate. It's fun. It's fulfilling. It's social. It's convenient.
You found your way onto the board.
Yeah, after about a year volunteering, the board was looking for a couple of people.
Yeah.
And so I put my hand up and, yeah, started working with the board. And back then, so this was about 2005, the board was chaired by a bloke called David Harrison. It still is. And I don't want him to go anywhere because he's just got this incredible brain. He's such a good person, you know, just great problem solver, and fantastic way with people. And yeah, but I think that part of it has been that journey that I've had with him. I mean, the thing about Fair Share is it's never been, I've never wanted to make it about me or about a guru. I've always wanted that leadership to be dispersed and to really provide an opportunity to engage people to contribute. And so when I look back over the journey, there's been some terrific people who have played some really important roles within the organisation.
How did the opportunity to lead and run the organisation pop up? And
yeah, we had we're having conversations at a board level around the potential and, you know, should we give it a bit of a nudge and put on a full-time CEO position. And back then we had a tiny rented kitchen in South Melbourne that we had access to about 5 hours a day, and we had a chef and a driver, and that was it. Mm. But a few of us thought it had legs, so we advertised. And in fact, no, before we made that decision, I put up my hand and said, look, I'm going to declare a conflict of interest. I might actually apply for the job. So I stepped out of the room metaphorically, and the board decided to advertise, and I got the job. I guess I had the inside lane because they knew me and I knew the organisation. And yeah, so I got the job and set up my spare bedroom and home as an office and started to fundraise. And the first goal was to try and raise enough money to set up a dedicated kitchen that we could scale up in, that we could control. And
how does that process look like? Like, because you've got a vision.
Yeah, well, it was, we had some funding from a couple of sources, and then one day a woman who volunteered with us rang up and said, oh, I'll never forget this, Mum would like to make a donation. So I got a scrap bit of paper out and said, oh, that's lovely, Annette, thanks. Can I'll take down her credit card details. Oh, it's a bit bigger than that. She'd like to donate $250,000 towards Fair Share establishing a kitchen. And I was like,
wow.
And then, so I went and made a cup of tea and said, right, okay, that's a good day. And then a couple of months later, she rang David, our president, who then rang me and said, look, we're actually going to up it substantially. So, we had the means to buy a small seafood wholesale, but a property that a seafood wholesale business was running in Abbotsford. And we, stripped it and put a small kitchen in, and that really, it's May 2008, and that really gave us wings, because then we could start working with Fonterra and Heinz and Woolworths, and we could start going from one shift a day to two shifts a day to night shifts, and it grew.
Was it a big call for you personally, like when you were tossing up, so you know, the CEO of Environment Victoria, and you knew that you're going to walk out of there and walk into your bedroom and work out of your bedroom on a day-to-day basis like that, you know, you must have had something really clear in your mind that you wanted to set out to build and achieve. Was that a hard decision?
No, look, I knew it was the right time to leave Environment Victoria, and I just loved the concept of, right, well, called One Umbrella back then, but what Fair Share is, just the idea of using food that would otherwise be wasted and people coming together to cook meals to help those doing it tough. And I thought, look, it's not like doing advocacy on climate change. It's not divisive. It's not polarizing. It's something that's just a no-brainer. And I guess I look back on the environmental advocacy that I've done and realise that it's this is more suitable to me because there's not that high degree of conflict and agitation that I experienced in the past. And it's something where you can really bring together people with very different politics and different backgrounds, and they can come together. It's a bit like the MCG, great unifier.
Yeah.
Brings a great grounder, and I think that's the same as Fair Share's kitchen, that you get people from all walks of life coming together shoulder to shoulder, helping out. And one of the joys in it has been to just find people who are really engaged and have the capacity in terms of who they know or what they know or the time they have to give, and really harness that. And my old man, my stepfather, reckons I'm really a bit lazy because I delegate a lot of things and say, hey, could you do this to me? Mum reckons I'm a fantastic delegator because – but look, the truth of it is that people really want to help and that love being asked to help.
Mm.
And if you go out there and say, hey, Mark, you know so-and-so and I reckon they could really help us with this, then I'll send an email introducing you guys. But there's so many examples over the years of where I've just reached out to people and said, hey, could you help with this? Sometimes it's financially, sometimes it's pro bono services or equipment or just legwork. But yeah, it's just lovely because I think it really brings out the good in people.
Mm. Isn't that amazing? I mean, that must be like so cool to go to work each day and you're working in an environment that's pulling the good out of people, and you're seeing that on a day-to-day basis. That's pretty cool.
And then you, on your commute home, somebody cuts you off, gives you the bird and screams at you.
Yeah, okay,
back to the real world.
That's true.
For our audience out there, can you give us, and we can deep dive into this, how does it actually work? How do you source food? And is it gifted to you? Do you have to go out and hunt for it? Is it different to what it was 15 years ago when you started?
We're not dumpster diving, Nick. Yes, it is different. We have some businesses that we work with, farmers, manufacturers, importers, supermarkets, which are regular donors. They regularly have surplus food, but then you get the occasional calls from somebody who's gone onto Google and looked up donations, surplus food.
Where can I dump my goat?
And so that's how it rolls. We've got a fleet in Melbourne of refrigerated vehicles that can take two or three pallets, a refrigerated truck as well that can take about 8 pallets. So when we get those calls, it's about really being responsive and professional, really well organised for those businesses that just want that food gone.
So what are the nuances within this, you know, food that's almost, or surplus food as you described it?
Look, I mean, the best thing is to give you some examples. We got a call one day from the Docklands. The studio down there had finished filming the one and only season of Iron Chef Australia, and they had 400 kilos of food left over on set.
400 kilos.
And so they rang us up. They rang up Second Bite. They rang up Old Harvest. We were the quickest ones to respond. We were down there within an hour with a van loading it up. It's an incredible haul. I remember there were saffron jars and jars of saffron threads. It's like, wow, great with that tagine. Calls like that. Yeah, you'll get SBC has a food services arm, and they do 44-gallon drums of crushed tomato. And last year, for reasons, I mean, this is small scale for them, but massive for us. Yeah. We got offered 70 pallets of 44-gallon drums of crushed tomatoes. So, and immediately on the email to Mark Mazurek at Lynn Fox, the CEO there, saying, hey, look, we've got this wonderful opportunity. We've got these crushed tomatoes and I'll see what I can do. Sure enough, sent down to Lynn Fox B doubles from Shepparton to Melbourne to transport this product for us. So
for nothing.
For nothing, for Nix. So,
yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, thank you to the Foxes. In the supermarkets, we're forever going to the supermarkets. We've got about 100 stores, Woolworth stores around Melbourne that we visit, and we're picking up their meat and their vegetables and their fruit and their eggs. So then the magic happens where you harness all of this wide variety of food, and so we've got this and we've got that and we need to use that, and then we've got a bit of time on that. Right, what can we make? And the cookers are between 150 and 200 litres, so it's not a saucepan on a stove like you used to.
Yeah.
They're ovens that are 6 feet high, and they're brat pans, as we call them, that you could have a – you could sink into your deck out the back of your place and make a jacuzzi out of. They're huge.
Yeah. Has the attitude of the corporates, supermarkets as an example, SPCs, et cetera, like, has their attitude changed over time in terms of working with your organisation to save this food and ensure that it does get into the mouths of those that need it?
Yeah, it certainly has. Initially, when we were just getting going, this is I started about 3 or 4 years after we got going, but in those early days we were knocking on food businesses' doors and business was saying, yes, we've got surplus food, yes, we'd like to give it to you, but our lawyers are preventing it. So we teamed up with the Law Council of Victoria, some young lawyers there who helped us pro bono to lobby the BRACS government. Back then, John Thwaites was Minister for Health, to get some legislation in that's commonly known as the Good Samaritan Law. And that really paved the way for businesses to donate to us with legal cover. That really changed its practices. And what was what really gave us a shot in the arm was shortly after I started, gradually this Good Samaritan Law that we got up in Victoria started being adopted in other states. Other groups started championing it.
Mm.
And then when there was blanket coverage or near blanket coverage across Australia, Woolworths said, right, now we've got this uniformity, let's start putting our toe in the water here. So they rang us up and said, we'd like to do a pilot with you where you visit two of our stores daily and see what you can take away and whether you could use it. So that was the – I said, why two stores? Let's go to 10. But no, they were right, because we had to learn and refine, and we went from two stores to four to eight. As I said, now 100. And, they were really at the vanguard of that movement now. And it's interesting, a few years ago there was a lot of movement over in Europe about governments banning food being thrown out, that it needed to be offered to charities first. And there was quite a bit of agitation here where people were saying, well, you should call for a ban in Australia. It's like, well, why? Well, these supermarkets throw away all this food. It's like, well, no, not really, because they offer it to us first, and to OzHarvest and to Food Bank, to Second Bite. So I don't see that you need to impose something on a business that's the business is already doing. And a few years after Woolworths started, Coles started, and they all do it now.
Yeah.
So they'd rather us come and collect it than pay a contractor to come and remove it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a financial benefit.
Yeah.
As well as their staff and their customers seeing food that, you know, they couldn't use, go to feed hungry people.
On the hungry people, are the numbers of those that are doing it tough, doing it rough and hungry, is that declining or increasing? Is it, you know, you think about your time in the business over the last 7-8 years, is it stable or what's it look like?
Yeah, look, it's, I don't want to be alarmist. It has grown, and it's grown pretty steadily. Over the last year, it's been quite interesting to watch, with Job Seeker putting more money into people's pockets. A lot of charities have reported that the people that they normally see have reduced in numbers, not seeing as many, but they did. They have seen a big increase in people on working visas who've come in from overseas, international students, and especially young people. So people who lost their part-time jobs whilst maybe they were involved in tertiary studies, in retail, in hospitality. So different people have emerged during the pandemic that we've been cooking for.
Can you put a number on it, like, just so that we can educate people? Like, how many people are you feeding throughout the year?
We're cooking around, last year we did just under 4 million meals. I'd estimate that would, who knows, it's tens of thousands. It's hard to put a number on how many people that's helped, how often people are getting that food. But look, it's a sector effort. It's not just Fair Share. There's some other terrific food charities out there that are contributing. What we really focus on is the cooking bit, because when Ingham's Chicken has 6 pallets of chicken breast with 2 days on it, and the business insists on it being cooked and not frozen, then we're the only ones that can do it,
right?
Because we've got the scale, we've got the experience, the people, the policies, the support around us in order to do that. To not only cook it, but then also to distribute it out. And it's one of the beauties of this model. And it's not to say we're better than other food charities, but we can stop the clock on food. So when you've got that chicken with only 2 days left on it, we can cook it in our Brisbane facility, chill it, blast chill it, vacuum seal it, freeze it, and then some people are doing it tough within an Indigenous community in far northern Queensland. 2 months later, could be enjoying that chicken casserole.
Wow.
So it's just, it's got that benefit. And that's where for us, it's about collaborating with others. So it's about collaborating with Second Bite, with Food Bank, to provide a solution, not just to businesses, but to other charities that have access to surplus food, because there is a lot out there.
Mm.
Businesses are certainly getting better at reducing their volumes, but there's still a lot there. And for us as a sector, what I really try to do is get us to work together with our respective strengths, and Fair Shares is the cooking bit.
Have you nailed it? Like, when you think about that whole ecosystem and what you do, like what are the things that keep you awake at night? And, you know, what are the first things that reach into your brain in the morning and say, oh, shit, I've got to solve this?
Yeah, I don't know whether you can solve humans being competitive. You think just because it's a community space and you've got a common mission that you will team up and work together? Yeah, no. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
And look, these organisations have got ambition. They want to control it. They want to do things their way. Their solution's better than someone else's. Fundraising's competitive. Profile raising, securing food donations, it's all competitive.
Mm.
But you know, as much as possible, we really endeavour to work with other charities rather than compete. And there's some great collaboration happening. So you take your wins where you can get them.
Yeah. Tell us about your team. It's a pretty small team, isn't it, that is bringing all these people together, the thousands of people that you've got volunteering. And
yeah. Look, it's an incredible team. For me, we've really got to a point now where I felt a year or so ago it needs somebody with a different set of experiences and skills to what I have to really lead part of the organisation. We've had a terrific woman who for 11 years had run our operations. She'd moved to Brisbane to set up the Brisbane facility, which is bigger than the Melbourne one, and going great guns. But we really needed somebody in Melbourne who could sustain what we'd become and expand it and to grow our impact from here. And that made me really nervous, because an appointment like that's critical in terms of somebody's experience, their hard skills, but especially their soft skills, whether they're going to fit culturally, you know, whether you're going to get organ rejection by bringing them in. It was really scary. But somebody I'd got to know very, very well over the last few years was ready to make a move, and I'm just incredibly excited to be now working alongside him. Similar in many respects, but very different in others, and really complement each other.
Nice.
So it's really sweet.
Cool.
Peachy.
Hey.
But not easy. I mean, in terms of the working relationship's fantastic. Look, it's COVID's presented real need. It's thrown up a great deal of opportunity. But it's a shifting environment which we're working with, and we have been responsive, and we need to continue to be. And as the organisation's much bigger now, so we really need to respond to the times. And we're fortunate not just to have Paul having joined us. But the organisation's sticky. People tend to have joined as staff and hung around.
Yeah.
So there's some great people there who have a lot of experience. You know, if I think about Rosie, who started with us when we had a few hundred volunteers as our volunteer coordinator, having coming out of the corporate sector in HR, 10, 11 years later, has mobilised a community of 1,500 regular volunteers and a couple of hundred corporates to get involved with corporate volunteering. And
logistical nightmare.
Oh, it's massive. I mean, yeah. She's, I think, half Spanish by blood, but she runs the play and has the temperament. A fellow Iberian can testify to that, but runs the place like a German engineer. And you need that because you can't just be all sort of community and really lovey-dovey when you've got to get 100 people a day into that Melbourne kitchen to volunteer. It's got to be really well run. So, I mean, we're fortunate to have a team of people who are passionate about what we do, who are really capable and highly committed.
I reckon as you look across Australia and across the globe, there's millions and millions and millions of people that are following the straight line because they feel like they should. And I think there'd be millions of people just jumping up and down on the same spot. Tell us, how is curving away from that straight line and pursuing something that you're passionate about and that does light something up in your soul, how has that changed your life?
How's it changed my life? Look, a lot more fulfilled, obviously. That's what was missing, and that's certainly there now. I've become a lot more confident as a person from having done this because... I remember being a nervous 28-year-old sitting in meetings of half a dozen people now having to do a live interview with Fran Kelly on Radio National where you just don't think about how many people are listening to you. I was speaking to one of my son's teachers the other day and he was talking about the importance of doing things that you succeed in to build confidence, and he said, but they need to be challenging. So you need to challenge yourself, take yourself out of your comfort zone, and then have success to then build confidence and then to have a go again and again and then have more impact and build confidence. And it's just self-perpetuating. But I remember that nervous 28-year-old when he started at Environment Victoria just was so shy of public speaking. The thought of doing media just freaked me out. But so that twice a week at night I would go and meet with a local conservation group somewhere in Victoria and have a chat to them and talk about my vision and where I wanted the organisation to go, what we're doing, how we could support them and listening to them. And that really just built and just throwing myself and doing as much media as I could to just build confidence to be able to advocate for what I believed in.
Mm. And you're getting up each day knowing that you're making a difference for tens of or hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's incredibly fulfilling and it's fun. And I just feel incredibly lucky, but well, maybe fortunate. Maybe you create your own fortune.
Yeah, I reckon you put yourself in the way of luck.
Yeah. And look, I'm getting all gooey, but I'm just going in every day or even just from home during COVID over the blower, speaking to people. So many people have engaged in what we do and got involved in it because we've reached out to them. And as I said before, people love being asked to actually feel as though they've got something that's valuable to contribute to something that's worthwhile. So
super cool.
So what does the future hold for Fair Share? You've got Brisbane now,
mm-hmm.
Yep. And you've got that running at full capacity. How does it expand or does it consolidate?
Look, we've chased this is what happens when we get a few accountants together. We've chased numbers. So we've been cooking more and more years, and each time, you know, people like David Harris and Philip Brass on the board have been looking at the numbers, how many meals have we cooked. We're going to stop doing that because for us now it's really about diving into the needs, the health issues and the dietary needs of different groups of people who we're helping, and to really hone what we prepare in the kitchen to meet those nutritional priorities for different groups. So Maggie Beer's done some terrific work putting the spotlight on the needs of elderly people living in nursing homes and their dietary needs. They need calories in their diets. They really need it's a real priority for them, calories and protein. Whereas if you're trying to assist where it's needed and where it's wanted, food insecurity in Indigenous communities, then it's not so much about calories. So it's really just understanding those different cohorts and honing what we cook to those needs, and also about being proactive in trying to find the ingredients, either surplus and donated or just straight out donated by businesses to cook what we need to cook.
You've got 1,000 volunteers, 1,000 on the waiting list. So for those people listening that would like to help, what can they do?
Well, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. I'll be careful saying that, but
we can edit it out.
No, look, it's one of those things that if you're somebody who's really engaged in the issue and really wants to help and persists, then and can find a way of making yourself relevant, then you know, you'll get our attention. If you're an experienced chef who wants to give up a day a week or half a day a week or an evening a week to come in and help out in the kitchen, then, you know, it will probably fast track you because that'll be really helpful.
Yeah.
But look, there's so many examples of people who are involved, who've reached out and said, look, I could volunteer in your kitchen, but I reckon there's another way that I could assist. Have you thought about, or do you need, or can you tell us about what you need? And I think that's what Fair Share is. It's not a charity. It's a community of those individuals and businesses that have said, yeah, I can help in this way. And we've really harnessed that.
And you've obviously built that culture and allowed that to happen.
Yeah. And look, I think from a donor's perspective, it means that your donation goes a lot further because Fair Share is not paying for this. They've got PwC doing that and Sealed Air doing this and Woolworths doing that and Linfox doing that. So they've found ways of getting these businesses involved using their products or services, gratefully and respectfully, but it keeps our costs down. It makes us sustainable. It means we can do more.
Last one.
Hawthorne's not going to win the flag.
I think we'd agree with that. How do you look after you? Like, you know, you've got a really taxing job, you've got a young family. What do you do to after yourself?
Oh, Lisa looks after me. She just says, Marcus, go for a run.
Right.
You need to run. We need you to go for a run.
And a long one at that.
Look, there's certainly that. There's exercise. If I go a couple of days without getting some endorphins, I'm crawling up the walls. And you're just sensitive to your own brain chemistry. It's like, God, I need something. Now, it's about really looking after yourself with a good diet and being moderate, eating well, eating nutritiously, getting sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the boys can make it hard, but, so it's just, I think, listening to a podcast on the weekend, it was talking about choices you make to put yourself in the right frame of mind to make good decisions. And if you're looking after yourself physically, yeah, for example, getting a good amount of sleep, then you'll actually make better decisions at work. So, certainly a lot of exercise. And I think just being self-aware, I mean, I'm an extrovert and I love people and I get energy from people. So just tapping into that community of people at Fair Share, but also friends, friends as well. But, yeah.
Hey, Marcus. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today on the Doolanders. I think Australia is so grateful that you decided to move off that straight line and the what you've done in creating the community at Fair Share and the work that you do is just amazing. And thank you again.
It's a pleasure. It's fun talking to you guys.
Thanks, Marcus.
Cheers.
There you go, Blake.
Yeah, there you go. And Marcus can run too. Like he hasn't delved in it too much there, but he's quick.
Yeah, he is. What has he done?
Oh well, I was talking to him last week, and he was saying that. I said, what's the best run you've ever done? He's actually what are those guys that do the
paces?
The paces. He's been a pacer for the Melbourne Marathon a whole bunch of times, and like I think he's running it in 3 hours, something ridiculous, super quick, but just loves that community spirit.
Yeah,
out on the run, similar to what he's done at work.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you think what you see now? You think, I guess he's got great people on the board. There's funding available. They're well known. It was just easy to sort of pop up out of nowhere. But as you heard, it's he didn't actually talk about it. He's very humble. It's not easy to go from your bedroom office to being what they are today, and clearly one of the most capable businesses of that type in Australia. And that's come about because he's trusted his staff. So he's obviously hired well, but he's then gone, nah, you make that decision. And that's the sign of a really good CEO who trusts the people around him rather than being a dictator. And you can see it rub off in the way he talks about the organisation. You're actually drawn in and you just go, all right, Marcus, you've sold me. How do I do something here to help?
Mm.
And that makes him such a influential person in that part of the not-for-profit sector.
Yeah. Pursued his passion, jumped off the hamster wheel, jumped off the straight line and just went and did some stuff that he actually cared about.
Yeah.
Got to be a massive lesson in that for many, many people, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, love that story. What a great story. Good on Marcus.
It is. And that's the end of episode Cyril Rioli. And how great was it? We had Marcus there. He's a Hawthorn supporter.
Yeah, how do you think we'll actually go? I mean, we,
the Hawks.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I don't think very well.
Do I? All right. Thank you, guys. Thanks for listening. Until next time.